The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thank you for coming this morning, comrades, making it out of the hangover slot here to deal with some very serious issues, so I appreciate your diligence. If you've been at this conference all weekend, you certainly understand the political moment that we're in right now, with the Trump election emboldening the far right in numerous disgusting and dangerous ways. You've heard of the lynching of Richard Collins III in Maryland. You've heard of the lynching of Nabra Hassan in Virginia. You've heard of the brutal stabbing assault and double murder on the train in Portland, Oregon. You've heard of the acquittal of the cop who murdered Philando Castile in Minnesota. You've heard of the cops murdering Charlena Lyles in Seattle. You've heard of the spike in deportation arrests and targeting of activists by ICE. You've heard, perhaps, that the number of explicitly anti-Muslim organizations in the US has tripled since 2015, with now over 100 such groups. You've heard of the string of bomb threats against Jewish community centers. And you've heard of the attacks on left-wing professors, Dr. Kianga Yamada Taylor at Princeton, Dr. Dana Cloud in Syracuse, Dr. Johnny Eric Williams in Trinity College. Now, I mention this gruesome list not because we're going to go into more details of any of these horrors, or that I'll somehow try and add to the powerful and moving words you've already heard from the other speakers of the sessions throughout the weekend, but because these terrible crimes provide the crucial context for what we're trying to present this morning. Now, in case you didn't hear, yesterday in Charlottesville, Virginia, about 50 Ku Klux Klan members showed up to rally at a statue of Confederate war criminal and defender of slavery, General Robert E. Lee. This is the very same statue in the same so-called Justice Park in Charlottesville where Richard Spencer, perhaps the most famous Nazi in the United States today, thanks to the viral footage of him getting punched in the face at Trump's inauguration. This was the same statue where he led a small group of torch-wielding protesters in May. However, yesterday, over 1,000 people defied the patronizing calls from city officials and liberal groups. Thank you. They ignored these patronizing calls to picnic on the other side of town and ignore them, and turned out in mass numbers to directly confront this fascist gathering, armed with Black Lives Matter signs and chanting, "Racists, go home!" And, "When Black Lives Matter are under attack, what do we do?" Thank you. There was this huge multiracial crowd that made sure the Nazis knew they were not welcome to openly parade through the streets of Charlottesville. Now, of course, the Klan was being escorted by riot police, who attacked the crowd with pepper spray and tear gas, making 23 arrests after declaring the demonstration against Nazis an unlawful assembly. But I believe this is really important, that this is the latest crucial link in a chain that includes the massive protests in Portland in the wake of the murders there. It's another step in rebuilding the mass character of the anti-fascist movement in the United States. Now, you've also heard about the dire conditions and despair that serve as a breeding ground for these festering and reactionary ideas to take hold. You've heard about the opioid crisis and what I found the shocking statistic that more people died in the United States thanks to the opioid crisis than both the wars in Vietnam and Iraq combined. You've heard about austerity, attacks on unions, privatization, unemployment, and the many forms of violence that result from poverty. Now, we know it's not just since the Trump election. All of this has been going on for generations. But it is accelerating, and that has everything to do with the political climate that we're in, and especially the condition of our mainstream political parties. Far from 8 years of the first black president ushering in an era of prosperity for black and brown communities, we've seen an unprecedented expansion of the police state, mass surveillance, the militarization of the police that acts as an occupying army in our cities. We've had more deportations under Obama than any other president in history, although Trump is trying to outdo his predecessor. This is really pissing me off. All right. And of course, the continued destruction of jobs, lives, rising debt, deteriorating health, and much more. For decades, the living conditions of working people of all races in this country have continued to decline under both Democrats and Republicans. our so-called two-party system sets us up for a bipartisan race to the right in the name of chasing swing voters. The war on drugs, the war on terror, the war on immigrants, all of these things have been supported by both parties, and they enable and normalize these horrific acts, both committed by individuals and structural acts. But these attacks are speeding up, getting more intense and more bold, and we have to rise to this challenge and find effective ways to resist. Now, I'm going to share a quote from an amazing work by Leon Trotsky called Wither France that he wrote in 1934, talking about what the conditions in France were as fascism had already come to power in Italy and Germany and was rearing its very dangerous head in France. He said, "Nothing is more dangerous in politics, especially in a critical period, than to repeat general formulas without examining their social content." And this is something that we're going to try and return to over and over again in this talk, of having to really understand the moment you're in to figure out what we can do about it. So just to give a little structure now for what we're going to try and lay out, you might believe this is a debate up here between the two of us based on how it was in the program, but that's not the case. We actually totally agree on almost all of this, although we might differ in some minor details of, you know, what somebody says. But so it's not like I'm going to present one end of the spectrum and he's going to present another. We're going to share our time as much as we see fit to try and present a coherent case of what's going on. And we've boiled down, both in the experience of the other talks in this conference and in our own research and thinking about these issues, four key strategic principles that we have to think about. And there's handouts, if you got a chance, they're on the back or the front, depending on your point of view. But I'll just restate them here. A, the state won't do this for us, and that asking them to do so is a disaster for our side. B, we have to confront them. We cannot ignore the far right and expect it to go away. C, we need a mass movement to do so. And that if the anti-fascist movement in this country remains small, isolated, like just a teeny little hardcore of the people who really get it, that's doomed. And finally, and in some ways most importantly, D, we have to present a political alternative. The far right provides imaginary answers to these very real problems, and we need to provide real answers instead. And then in conclusion, given these four principles, how can we think through our tactics today and some wider lessons? And so we're just going to kind of take turns, pass it back and forth. So I'm going to turn it over now to John to talk about who are the far right and what is their strategy.
Okay. Thank you, Derek. So when we were trying to think about how to prepare for this, one of the things we realized is that if we're going to be really emphasizing that tactics and strategy always depend on the context, you know, the level of consciousness and the level of organization on our side, you know, they also depend on really understanding the level of consciousness and organization on their side. And so we decided we needed to spend a little bit of time kind of mapping out a little bit the far right. This is not going to be exhaustive, but what we're going to try and do is lay out a framework for how to kind of understand who the different groups are. We might all disagree about exactly where to put this or that group, but hopefully we can convince you of the utility of the framework. And so the metaphor we came up with when thinking about this, and you'll see this if you look at the handout, is that the far right is like the right generally is like an onion, you know, of concentric circles. There's a core and there's different layers outside of the core. So we're going to start with I'm going to go through some examples of groups in the different layers before saying a bit more about why we chose that metaphor and why we think it's useful. So the core, the people who are kind of what we're calling people who are fascists in virtue both of their deeds and their political program, you know, there are some different elements to it. There's more traditional, you know, fascist elements such as like the Klan, racist skinheads, Hammerskin Nation, you know, people who run like a record label in the South for like racist music or something. And there's newer forces such as the Traditionalist Workers' Party led by this guy, Matthew Heimbach, people have probably seen. You know, this guy is particularly dangerous because they've got a kind of, you know, they're not just organizing on campuses, though they also did that for a little while. They're trying to kind of figure out how to capitalize on the terrible conditions that exist among lower middle class and working class people in rural areas. They start, some of the things they say sound like they might be leftists. You know, they say some of the same things we might if we were organizing in a rural community and drawing attention to poverty and trying to do something about it. So they're not necessarily going to lead with like a flyer about, you know, like the Jews and the banking system or something like that. They're going to talk about how all the jobs are leaving and, you know, how we need to take care of each other. And then, you know, your third or fourth meeting in, you'll get that flyer. Or increasingly, they're becoming more confident to lead with that stuff. But another
important piece of the kind of people who are fascist in virtue of both deeds and programs, the National Policy Institute. So Derek already mentioned Richard Spencer. Spencer is a kind of strategist and intellectual. You know, he's really well-read in the entire history of far-right organizing all over the world, and he's been kind of behind helping the far-right in the U.S. to adopt so-called, you know, identitarian language, to take a vocabulary from the left and to turn that vocabulary and, you know, to right-wing ends. So the fascist core, the people who are fascists in virtue of deeds and program, it's pretty small right now, but it's very significant politically for our discussion. So the next layer outside of that we're calling the middle layer are people who are fascists mainly in virtue of deeds. They have a wider, you know, they have a set of ideas that, like, certainly they're very racist, sexist, you know, there's lots of really ridiculous stuff they believe, but there's not necessarily like a fascist program at the core of it, apart from the idea that, you know, the left is the enemy and the left has to be smashed and destroyed. And so these consist of, you know, militia organizations, three percenters, there's some smaller groups in the Midwest and South. They're often founded or led by ex-military people, mostly officers, but not entirely. Then there's, of course, the Proud Boys, Gavin McInnes, and the sort of smaller unit within the Proud Boys, the Fraternal Order of Alt Knights, led by this guy, Kyle Chapman. Some of these people, you know, started off as kind of libertarians in their professed politics, with, you know, a fair dose of racism mixed in there. But, you know, what they've, in the current period, I think the thing that distinguishes them is they've developed an orientation on street fighting tactics, right? You know, physical fighting on the streets against the left or against, you know, social movements. And so, you know, and of course they present this as a kind of self-defense. You know, the left and the liberals are taking away our rights and, you know, taking away our jobs and so on, and therefore we need to defend ourselves physically in order, or, you know, most importantly, they say that the left wants to take away people's right to free speech, and therefore, you know, we need to arm ourselves with sticks and you know, AR-15s or whatever. And so, you know, these are people who are, you know, right now, for some of them, their ideas are kind of lagging behind the reality of their practice of street fighting, and we can expect to see those two things begin to line up more and see an evolution over time. Some of them may not even understand themselves the true nature of their own politics, and that'll become clearer to them as the struggle kind of reveals it. And then the you know, the outer layer, what we're calling the outer layer of the onion, is, like, broadly speaking, you know, right-wing populism, the Republican Party. You know, there are groups within this layer that have a huge amount of social power, like the, you know, Congressional Freedom Caucus, or, you know, Fox News fans, fundamentalists. You know, people in the outer layer, it's pretty diverse. You know, conceivably, what unites them all, for the purposes of our metaphor, the onion, is just all the people whom the inner and middle layers see as the audience, who they're trying to, you know, get them to either, you know, if not join their organizations, then to warm up to the ideas and practice, you know, to fascist ideas and practice. And so they have a particular strategy in the inner and middle layers for trying to get that to happen. So I'll come back to that in a second, but first a bit more on why we chose an onion metaphor. So again, it's not meant to be exhaustive. You know, there's plenty of other groups, and we might, you know, where do you put the NRA? You know, there are different parts of the NRA. You know, people saw that recruitment video that they put out, like, that's pretty scary, right? You know, but then, you know, there are other parts where, you know, it's they're not necessarily ready to, like, throw down in the streets and, you know, whatever. Now, where do you put Donald Trump? You know, so we might debate that, but what, you know, the structure that we're putting forward will allow us, I think, to have a discussion about that that helps us understand some of these things. So, it's not that the point of the metaphor isn't that the people at the center of the onion have a tremendous amount of social power. It's not like one of those, you know, Glenn Beck chalkboard drawings that has, like, you know, George Soros at the middle and a bunch of arrows, you know, pointing to, like, the ISO or whatever, and, you know, the Socialism Conference. It's, man, I wish we had that kind of social power. So in fact, you know, some people on the periphery of the onion have a lot more social power. And so the point of the metaphor is rather, you know, like, Richard Spencer is not pulling the strings of the Republican Party right now, right? We want to keep it that way. So the onion metaphor is about, you know, how to understand, like, where we need to kind of pull apart the layers in order to keep the core from growing. And so why an onion? You know, why concentric circles and not, like, a line, like, from center to right, or one of those, like, political chart memes, you know, with the quadrants? Because the closer you get to the outside of the onion, the more diverse the politics get, right? Like, it's not inconceivable that we will see some forces on the left that are extremely confused be pulled by or go over to you know, politics that exist in the middle. So, you know, they, you know, we use the concentric circles metaphor sometimes as Leninists. It's important. I think they think in terms of this metaphor, and that's very important for understanding some of what's going on. So, okay, that's what the point of the onion, you know, isn't. But what is the point? If you've ever cut into an onion in your kitchen, you know, where it's really humid and you've left it there for too long and it's rotting, you know, they rot from the inside out, right? You know, often when you're cooking, you can save a good part of the onion if you find and cut out, you know, the rotting part. You know, you're not going to eat a raw onion. You know, it tastes kind of nasty. Well, maybe, whatever. But, you know, you've got to cook it, right? So, you know, we're not talking about, like, recruiting to revolutionary socialist groups from the outer layer necessarily right away, but we are talking about figuring out how to keep the rot from spreading. So you've got to find and cut out the rot and separate it from the rest of the onion. Okay, so there are some divisions that exist within the onion. You know, people at the center are generally for replacing bourgeois democracy with dictatorship. They're for these homogenous ethno-religious communities, you know, secession from the United States, et cetera, you know, there's a bunch more we can go through. It's not very attractive, or hasn't been for a long time, to people in the outer layers, and that's starting to change. How is it starting to change? And this is the key thing. You know, So I'll finish this bit with a little bit about how the rot is spreading right now. It might not always spread this way, it might change. So one way it might change in the future, fascists at a higher level of struggle try to appeal to people who have political power and present themselves as, like, useful in smashing the left, right? I don't think we're quite at that point, though we could be getting there at some point. I think right now it's mainly that the people in the inner layer want to try and popularize street fighting and normalize political violence by spreading this narrative, which already exists because of the right-wing populace. It's this narrative that exists among the outer layer that, you know, liberals and the left and the, you know, media and, you know, university elites on the coast, whatever, you know, they want to take away our rights, our jobs, our right to bear arms, our right to speak and assemble, and so therefore we have to defend ourselves, right, against that, and that requires arming ourselves. And so, you know, one consequence of that is that If we end up doing things like, you know, doing the kind of shut it down protests against people in the outer layer, and there's some risk, it's not a given, but there's some substantial risk that we end up playing into precisely the narrative that the inner layer wants to promulgate in order to recruit the outer layer. Does that make some sense? No, it's not a given that that happens. So part of it, and another key thing to understand, is that the inner layer's appeal to the outer is premised on the idea that actually, like, the majority of white people are, or just people in general, not just white, are, you know, are like racist and only want to be, you know, with their own community. And but people are afraid to say this because of, you know, political correctness or whatever. So if only, like, the brave people who are willing to defy political correctness get up and say racist things, then all the rest of the people will be confident in expressing their racism. And so, you know, if we, you know, shut it down with a small minority and they go home bruised and beaten, they may be able to just present themselves as martyrs. If we're not able to show that the majority of people are opposed to the racism that they claim the majority of people actually, you know, believe in and hold. And so that's how the onion, right, how the rot is spreading right now within the onion. So, you know, that may change, and we'll have to have a different approach as it changes, but right now I think that's how it's spreading. So that's kind of got to be the context for how we think about some of this stuff. All right, let's see. And now we're passing it back to Derek.
Great, so now we're gonna address our four key strategic principles on what do we do about this rotting onion. I'm gonna start with the question of the state won't do it for us. And we can't give the state any power to restrict democratic rights. I'm gonna read a quote from Hal Draper's piece, Free Speech and the Political Struggle, where he says, "Of all the juridical weapons, we cannot entrust to a state machine that is not ours. The worst is the right to be selective about democratic rights. Because the state will make that a weapon, a double-edged one, and the sharp cutting edge will be used against the people, not against the fascists, in the long run, if not in the short." And so just to say, this was the entire basis of the McCarthy witch hunt against radicals, communists, and socialists. There was this narrative of, their ideas are so dangerous to our way of life that we must crush them for expressing themselves, lest they destroy liberty itself. And you know, so therefore, bow down before the repressive apparatus of the state and let us police the hearts and minds of the population, ridding it of all unsavory elements, right? And so that, to the extent that people gave in to these ideas of allowing the state to decide who can and can't speak, it was used to crush the left. Every time we give more power to the state, they use it against us. So, for example, representing what I consider the "we had to bomb the village to save it" logic from Vietnam War, there are now efforts actively underway in various states, supposedly in the name of defending free speech, that make heckling a crime. Directly on point is the question that many black bloc people have been arrested and charged with crimes involved with wearing a mask. And these crimes were put on the books originally to try and go after the KKK. Hate crime punishment enhancements, supported by various sections of the left, are being used against the left, against people of color defending themselves, against racist attacks, and so on. Now you see the specter of Blue Lives Matter laws that are trying to classify the police as a group that requires special protections against hate crimes. On and on and on. I'm going to raise a potentially contentious point I tried to raise in 30 seconds yesterday in a discussion, and I'll give it a little more justice here, I hope. Which is, I think it's important for us to distinguish between giving up a legal right, what the lawyers would call abrogating a right, and then the idea of taking away the exercise of a right. Taking away the opportunity to exercise a right. And I believe there's an ocean of difference between asking the state to restrict anyone's right to free speech and saying that we should exercise our rights in an attempt to prevent another group from an opportunity to express theirs or to exercise theirs. So we are unconditionally for the legal right of anyone to assemble and speak, always. We never call on the state to limit that right. But their rights and, you know, their right to free speech is also our right to free speech. And it does not mean that we are in favor of fascists getting together unopposed and freely exercising that legal right. We need to challenge that. So we defend their legal right, knowing that if we don't, and we give the state any power or authority to decide who gets to speak, they'll use that against our side 1,000 times more than against the fascists. But the legal right to speak doesn't guarantee you an audience. And we are absolutely in favor of preventing fascists from having a chance to exercise that legal right, given the appropriate circumstances and conditions, and we'll get into that more. There's also that XKCD comic on your chairs that addresses this point nicely. And just an aside, there is a debate, and I'll just name it, that some comrades in the organization are advocating for a broader understanding of the right to free speech, that it's not just a legal right protecting you from the state, there's different formulations, there's this idea of like a cultural right to free speech, that it's not just about the state repressing speech, but anybody repressing speech, it's a problem, et cetera, et cetera. Honestly, I think that that position, this like broader conception that it's this sort of universal right that applies in all circumstances, is very problematic if we then say we need to shut them down, which in some circumstances we do. And I think that the distinction between, we're not asking the state to shut them down, we're not asking for attacking their legal right from above, we're talking about people from below using our rights to prevent them from exercising a right that we believe they should still legally have. And I hope that's clear, and I hope if people have disagreements, questions, by all means, bring it on. So the next point is this idea that cops and Klans go hand in hand. You've maybe heard that in a chant or seen it with your own eyes. There's a long history of white supremacists within the police, the immigration enforcement, border patrol, and so on. I grew up in New Orleans. Of course, there was all sorts of scandals of Klan members in the force. And then I moved to the Bay Area, well, by way of Madison, but whatever. Now I'm in the Bay Area, and gee, it turns out in the San Francisco Police Department, there's also rings of white supremacists openly sending texts to each other and blah, blah, blah. So it's not just a few bad apples in some sort of backwards states in the, you know, whatever, red USA. I'm going to read another quote from Wither Franz from Trotsky. But let us make one more fantastic hypothesis. The police disarm the fascists. Does that settle the question? And who will disarm the same police who, with the right hand, will give back to the fascists what they will have taken away with the left? The comedy of disarmament by the police will only have caused the authority of the fascists to increase as fighters against the capitalist state. Blows against the fascist gangs can prove effective only to the extent that these gangs are at the same time politically isolated. There's other examples. San Diego, a rally to call for Trump's impeachment. And the San Diego police just stood by and watched the Proud Boys come in and try and intimidate and harass the crowd. And when the violence breaks out, of course, the cops are more interested in arresting the left, not the right. The example I used earlier of Charlottesville in Virginia. I'll just say a story from when I was in Madison and organizing with the Midwest Network to stop the Klan. I had been active for a few years already. I had seen a lot of stuff, been to demonstrations, picket lines. I already like knew the cops weren't on our side. And then I got to a Klan rally, and I had never seen more police anywhere in my life. There were thousands of police, snipers, cops on horses, cops with dogs, lines and lines of riot police in Darth Vader suits. Like, rows and rows and fencing and more cops and more fencing. There was a free speech zone where we all had to go through metal detectors and have all of our faces directly photographed by these cops to go express our free speech rights to protest the Klan. And these thousands of cops were all facing us. All of their guns were trained on us. They were ready to just come into this little fenced-in area and just crush us all like we were the criminals. So, all right, I don't want to spend too long because we're getting too long. The bigger picture, there's a bipartisan project of racist scapegoating that's been going on for generations. And we can't expect a government that tries to deflect people's anger away from the capitalists onto immigrants, welfare cheats, drug users, Muslim terrorists, gang members, whatever the slur is. We can't expect these people to crack down on the far right that's simply taking those ideas one step further to their so-called logical conclusions. And I should just say, if the police are regularly getting away with murder in our streets, justified with the line, which was the case of in Philando Castile's murderer getting away, but he was black and I was afraid for my life. And that's enough. That's now like the legal precedent. If the cop can convince you that they were afraid for their life, it's open season. And how can we expect that same police force to effectively challenge a right wing that is also claiming that they're fearing for their life or their way of life whenever black people are involved? Another point of why the state can't solve this for us is that asking them to do so disempowers our side. We believe in socialism from below. We believe in the potential of ordinary people to run the world democratically. And in fact, that's the only hope for the world to survive in the long term. And this can only happen through self-emancipation, self-activity, collective power. Asking the forces of the state to solve the problem of the far right not only won't be effective, but it strips us of our own sense of collective power and initiative. It makes us passive spectators instead of active participants, and it trains us to rely on saviors from above instead of looking to ourselves and each other. So I'm going to read a quote from Eugene Debs. "I do not want you to follow me or anyone else. If you are looking for a Moses to lead you out of this capitalist wilderness, you will stay right where you are. I would not lead you into the promised land if I could, because if I led you in, someone else would lead you out. You must use your heads as well as your hands and get yourself out of your present condition. As it is now, the capitalists use your heads and hands." And then another quote from Trotsky, this time in a piece called "Freedom of the Press and the Working Class Relative to Mexico" in 1938. He's talking about this very right-wing reactionary press that was publishing all this awful shit. He says, "It is essential to wage an unrelenting battle against the reactionary press, but the workers cannot leave a task they have to fulfill themselves through their own organizations and their own press to the repressive fist of the bourgeois state." So to wrap up on this point, in periods of extreme crisis, history teaches us that the big capitalists would much rather arm, support, and allow a fascist movement to seize power and destroy democracy, so long as the fascists fulfilled their historic task of annihilating the workers' movement on their way to power. This is true whether that fascist movement was technically legal or not in the eyes of the existing bourgeois state. People might not know, but Hitler's Nazi party was illegal under the Weimar Republic. And there's a formulation that I think is also helpful to insert here, that you can't ban a mass phenomenon or a mass movement. So the state simply is not going to help us with this. And so I'm going to turn it back over to John for our next point.
Cool, thanks. Yeah, that, I just realized something we left out, that Trotsky quote in the Freedom of the Press and the Working Class piece in Mexico. The position he's arguing against is being put forward by a Stalinist trade union leader who is arguing for using the bourgeois state. That's important if you know some of the history. So, okay, the next point, you have to confront them. Insofar as we're organizing, trying to organize mass protests of fascists in the next couple of years, we are going to be encountering this argument a whole lot from people that are new to the socialist movement. And so I think, first it's important to say that we have to be very patient in taking on this argument, because it doesn't come from nowhere. It's not just like, oh, those silly liberals don't understand, they're real and they're naive, and sometimes that's true, but you also have to actually like walk alongside people and make an argument. And so there's at least one intuition behind why people say this that's somewhat rooted in reality, which is that if you confront the fascists with a small number of people and you're defeated and you do it badly, it can make them stronger, right? And that's something we've seen happen a fair amount in the last year. And so many liberals have seen that, and that kind of tends to reinforce their own their sense of
passivity, or of, you know, like, wow, we, you know, this really doesn't make sense for us to do. And so we have to make very clear when we're making this argument with liberals and forces to our right, people that are new to the struggle, that, you know, that confronting the right can actually weaken them, that, well, it depends on how you do it. And we're talking about doing it in a different way than people who just want to, like, get 10 of their best friends and throw down, you know, against, like, 10 other people or whatever. You know, we're talking, like, when we're, if we're going to have a fight, we don't want it to be a fair fight, as someone put it in a talk yesterday. You know, we want it to be like in Charlottesville yesterday, of, you know, 1,000 versus 50, right? Or, you know, 10,000, you know, whatever. So, okay, you know, I mean, one thing we can do in making this argument is go through some of the history about what happens when you do ignore them. Go through, you know, the Social Democratic parties in, you know, in France and Germany and in Italy, and how, you know, ignoring them really just allowed them to, you know, allow them to grow. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, because there have been other talks that have made that argument at this conference. One other thing that we're going to hear a lot from people that are new to this is, but, you know, isn't it just giving them the attention that they want by, you know, that was the argument that got made by the press and the mayor in Charlottesville yesterday. And I think we have to say, well, of course, I mean, we have to grant, yes, they do want attention, you know, we don't want to deny that. But it all, you know, people sometimes say, you know, not all press, or, you know, all press is good press, or, I'm getting that wrong. Anyway, that's wrong, you know, like, there's such a thing as good attention and bad attention, right? And attention that's like 1,000 people showing that racism is ridiculous and not popular, and these people are idiots and clowns, you know, who are like, you know, play acting something from the 1930s, you know. That's not good press for them. Whereas, you know, good press for them can sometimes be, you know, the outer layer getting attacked by a small number of people, you know. Or good press for them can also just be marching completely unopposed, you know, right. Like if we sing Kumbaya 5 miles away and they're able to, you know, like terrorize some people in a community, you know, et cetera. So, okay, that's, you know, the main thing that we're saying here is, and people largely, I think, in this room agree with this principle, but we have to be really patient in making this argument with other people around us. And so just very quickly, as we've got a lot of material here and not a lot of time. So on the question of, you know, the slogan, no platform for fascists, which gets used a lot, and the question of debating the far right. So one thing to say about is that fascists are not, you know, especially the people in the innermost layer who are really skilled ideologues, and an increasing number in the middle layer, you know, they're not like honest interlocutors. You know, they're much cleverer than most of the liberals that, you know, want to debate them. So we've seen fascists get taken onto these, like, you know, nightly comedy shows and stuff, and like the liberal person who's interviewing them usually wants to, like, try and, you know, it's like they're trying to convince Richard Spencer to, like, drop his racist views, you know? And like, I'm sorry, but that's just not going to happen, right? You know, and so, like, often when they get that kind of a platform, it ends up actually helping them. And so, you know, why is this? Well, you know, the fascists are saying that there's something fundamentally wrong with society. You know, they've got, you know, this is why Trump's slogan, Make America Great Again, was great for them, because it's implied by the slogan that there's something that's not great about living in the United States, and of course that's true. It's really not great for most people living in the United States. And liberals want to respond with a, you know, slogan kind of like Hillary Clinton's, you know, America is already great, you know. And so they don't, you know, their liberals are not really going to, the fascists are going to have an easier time winning people in that audience than the liberals, because liberals don't want to grant the premise of the fascists, which is necessary to grant in order to make an effective argument to the, you know. You know, fortunately, we don't really have the kind of movement or social power necessary to enforce a kind of blanket ban on liberals who want to invite fascists onto their talk shows. It would be great if we could get to the point where we're able to do something like that. And so right now, you know, that sense of the slogan, no platform for fascists, it's not clear that has a lot of, you know, meaning for us in this moment. But I think, you know, there are things like, you know, we definitely, especially people at the inner core and in the middle layers, you know, if they want to march, or if the Klan wants to march, like in Charlottesville, you know, we should try and, we have to oppose that. And if we have the numbers, potentially even deny them that platform. But at the same time, it's like, you know, if the press is going to come and interview a Klan member, which they're going to do, we may not have any control over that at this point in the development of our movement. And then we should not say, oh, well, we're not going to, you know, also go on TV and say what socialists think about what's wrong with this country and how to fix it, and how it's, you know, not, immigrants are not the problem, and, you know, racism is not the answer. We shouldn't refuse to be interviewed by the same television station who wants to air that clip 30 seconds after they interview Richard Spencer because, you know, no platform for fascists. So, in other words, you have to think about that slogan and what the point of it is and how it applies in a given situation, and not, you know, raise tactics to the level of principle in a way that means you're just applying a formula. Okay, now I'm going to throw it back to Derek to talk about point C.
All right.
So again, we have to confront them with lots of people. We're kind of addressing this, so I'm going to really speed through this. But just to frame this, we want the far right to be politically isolated. So what does that look like? We can't let them position themselves as being persecuted by a fringe minority, right? We need a majority of people to oppose them. They're opposing right now as a silent majority. Again, this idea that like they're the ones who are bold enough to actually say out loud what everybody thinks. But they're not. We are the silent majority, okay? It's not intimidating to their side to have a small group come try and beat them up. They're intimidated by a truly massive crowd that represents all aspects of life. And we have to show them that there's this overwhelming majority in the world that thinks that fascism are evil. Fascists are evil, and that this is wrong, and that we have to make the outer layer think twice before considering joining the inner layers. Just briefly, some words about Berkeley, where I've been organizing for many years now. Right after Trump was inaugurated, there was approximately 100,000 people marched in the Women's March in Oakland. I think that Oakland police said it was 60,000, but we all know they lie. Then, just like a few weeks later, Milo Yiannopoulos tried to come to UC Berkeley, and there was about, I mean, we can argue about the numbers, but somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 of us out in Sproul Plaza, the historic home of the free speech movement, to protest this pig. In the lead-up, there was an open letter of professors calling for this university to cancel the event, and we were advocating for this mass exercise of our rights to try and prevent this guy, an unopposed platform to do his thing. In the midst of this event, which there were some tactical mistakes, and we can get into that, but there were about 100 people in the Black Bloc who came out and took this protest in an entirely different direction. Started shooting fireworks at the police, started smashing windows, setting shit on fire. Where I was, right, basically in the thick of it, like, I didn't see a single person join them of those 2,000 people who were in the crowd. We were reduced to an audience. We were sort of pushed back, and they were like, hey, we're here now, we'll take over for you people. We'll do this right, since you're just a bunch of fucking liberals. And I mean, nobody actually said that to me, but that was the attitude. That was the attitude of what was being put on display. And so instead of a strategy that was trying to inspire this huge crowd to do something radical, like, hey, let's go inside and occupy this building, or hey, let's do something radical, it was the strategy of like, fuck you people, you don't get it, we get it, and we're gonna do it on your behalf. So in the wake of that, throughout the spring, there were two more far-right rallies in Berkeley, again, in the hypocritical slogan of free speech, and basically the only opposition was this hard Antifa left. And it's getting just harder and harder in Berkeley and in other places to get people to come out and oppose the far right, because people are starting to rightfully be afraid that they're just going to wind up in the middle of a brawl, and that regardless of how many Nazis go home with a bloody nose, the fascists are ultimately going to come out ahead for all the reasons we've been talking about appealing to this narrative of being the persecuted victims. And so in the battle of the streets, our primary strength is our numbers. It's not our, like, how, you know, whatever, how good our arsenal is or something. Another just quick point about who do we bring along. Just imagine for a moment if one or two unions were to adopt a fighting posture in the face of fascists and bring to bear the force of their numbers and organizations against the rally of the far right. So for example, imagine some Teamsters showing up with their trucks to block the parade route that the fascists were going to go down. Whether or not that's a relatively small section of the working class, that kind of protest would strike fear into the far right in ways that, you know, even twice as many anarchists might, because it represents so much more. It represents the organized force of the working class and represents massive potential power. So to avoid the jumping back and forth thing, I'm going to jump right now into point D, which is that we have to present a political alternative. Now, again, I said in the beginning, the far right gives imaginary answers to real problems, and while official liberalism denies that these problems even exist, in many respects, I think this is the most important point, because without it, nothing else we are going to do to fight the right is going to be effective in the long term. The problems that they're addressing are very real, and again, just we've talked about it, declining living standards, destruction of jobs and industries, massive and crippling private debt, the opioid epidemic, alcoholism, deteriorating infrastructure, cities, bridges crumbling, trains derailing, etc. Our lives and our environment are literally crumbling around us, and all of this leads to hopelessness, anger, and despair. The far right says that the fabric of our society is unraveling because of immigration, because of interbreeding, because of multiculturalism, and so on. Immigrants are stealing our jobs, inner cities are decaying because black people live there and their culture is somehow inherently flawed, male wages are declining because of feminism or affirmative action, so on and so forth. And the only way that these ideas have any traction is because they're trying to explain the reality of lived experience of increased immiseration. And again, this difference between make America great again on the right, and the liberals are saying America's already great. But we know the true cause of this misery is capitalism's relentless drive for profit. The 1% are rich because the 99% are not. Austerity, privatization, automation, speed-ups, layoffs, public policy that's transferring wealth from the bottom to the top. These are real explanations for why people are having a hard time right now in this country. And not just right now. But since the ruling class doesn't want us to see things in this way, they rely on all the ideological tools available to scapegoat things and groups that are not causing the problem. And they generally would rather we were angry at each other, not the 1%. And the far right is just taking the dog whistle racism and sexism and just makes it explicit. So to truly stop the far right, we have to not only confront them with mass action, we also have to provide real answers to these very real problems. Build a movement that is calling for genuine solutions like universal healthcare, free education, abolition of private debt, defending living standards and jobs through strikes and workplace occupations, and much, much more. In short, socialism from below. We need to build a stronger radical left as a means to building a much stronger and broad, a much stronger and larger broad left, and as a means both. We need to build a stronger radical left to build a stronger broad left, and we need to ensure that as that broad left is growing, it's not falling prey to liberalism and these half-hearted non-solutions or ignoring that there's even a problem. I'm going to read a quote from Kianga. The cancellation of my speaking events is a concession to the violent intimidation that was, in my opinion, provoked by Fox News. But I am releasing this statement to say that I will not be silent. Their side uses the threat of violence and intimidation because they cannot compete in the field of politics, ideas, and organizing. And this is, I think, a key point. The true strength of our side has not yet been expressed in its size and breadth. And so they believe they are winning. We have to change this dynamic and begin to build a mass movement against racism, sexism, and bigotry in this country. And again from Trotsky, blows against the fascist gangs can only prove effective to the extent that these gangs are at the same time politically isolated. So I'm going to turn it back to John for some concluding remarks.
Cool. Okay. So, you may have, in looking at these principles and thinking about them, you may have noticed that we have been in a situation in the last year or so where B and C, namely we have to confront them and we need a mass movement to do so, have been kind of in tension with each other, right? So you can't see the principles as just these like static, you know, they're going to interact, and sometimes we're going to need to emphasize one or the other in trying to get to a movement that is able to, in a balanced way, apply all four of them. And so one way to think about this, as I think Joel Geyer said in a meeting a couple days ago, you know, tactics are dependent on the balance of forces and the level of consciousness. And I would just add to that also the balance of forces and level of consciousness on the part of the far right and how that's being perceived by the people, you know, within their kind of united front of the right, which is one way to understand what the onion is. And so, you know, we've argued that stopping the growth of the far right right now is, or in general, is a matter of understanding at each moment how the inner layer is recruiting from the outer layer, or how the rod is spreading, or however you want to, you know, elaborate it in terms of this metaphor we've come up with, and then intervening strategically to stop this. So right now, the inner layer is posturing as defenders of free speech and baiting the left to physically attack them in order to legitimize political violence in the eyes of the outer layer, to expand the middle layer of people who are fascists by virtue of deeds. You know, and then eventually the core wants to help create those fascists by virtue of deeds into people who are fascists also by virtue of ideas. You know, and so in general, why are they doing this? They understand quite well that street violence and terror are the only way the right can gain power. You know, the lower middle class and the working class, insofar as it becomes sections of it become won over to fascist politics and organize, as fascists. You know, the strike weapon, they don't have the strike weapon available to them, you know, despite what, like, Ayn Rand might say. And so, you know, I thought that was going to be a laugh. And so, you know, they understand that, like, the way they have to do it is through street fighting. So the way that they're trying to expand right now is to expand the number of people to normalize street violence, to make that, like, a normal part of political life and what protest is like in this country. You know, and so...
you know, too much in the movement right now is playing in, unfortunately, to kind of amping up that narrative and helping the inner layers get pulled into the outer layers get pulled into the inner. So we have to stop that first. We're cutting the onion the wrong way, and some of the things we're doing are helping to strengthen it. And at this moment, that means helping to emphasizing especially point C, which we've been doing, you know, in Portland and other places. So, but once we get to a point where we rebuild the mass character of a movement and have protests like the one in Portland and like the one that took place in Charlotte. Or you could go back farther to a point before the election when the movement did have more of a mass character. You think about Trump being run out of UIC in Chicago. You know, that was a pretty awesome thing. Lots of people. You know, but by the way, at that, there was, you know, it was a mass movement, but there was also, I remember, like, seeing, you know, like, kids from the neighborhood, like, sprinting after, you know, like, these people wearing, like, tuxes and, like, ball gowns, you know, like, chasing them away from UIC, you know. And so, like, and that, I don't think that, I mean, like, I wouldn't necessarily, like, advocate that we do that, but, like, that flowed in a certain way from having a protest of, you know, 15,000 people or whatever it was. So it's not the same thing as, like, you know, somebody, like, going there with a black mask, like, with the intention of, you know. Okay, where am I at here? And so, you know, once we're able to rebuild the mass character of the movement, then it may be the case that, you know, there's a situation where we have to make the case to that mass movement that we're a part of, you know, that confronting them and something like physical disorganization becomes more of a necessity. That often will take the point of, like, the Nazis are marching from point A to point B. We want to stand in the middle between point A and point B and keep them from getting from point A to point B. So they have a feeling of demoralization, you know, when they couldn't actually make the march happen. That's one way to understand, like, you read about the Battle of, you know, of Lewisham or Cable Street. That's kind of what happened there. So it wasn't like going out and attacking them. I think we're very far from the point where, like, preemptive stuff would make sense. But it, you know, we foreclosed nothing. It's all a matter of just assessing where we're at. Just to blows against the fascist gangs can prove effective only to the extent that these gangs are politically isolated. And another Trotsky quote, when he's making the point about once you have a mass movement, you've got to kind of, give it a, then you can emphasize the confrontational and militant character. In Wither France, it's not, he's arguing against people who say they're all for the United Front and fighting the fascists, but then don't really do anything about it. So it's not that we deny the importance of the United Front. We demanded it when the leaders of the parties, you know, the liberals in this situation, were against it. The United Front opens up numerous possibilities, but nothing more. In itself, the United Front decides nothing. Only the struggle of the masses decides. And so the United Front is a way of bringing masses of people to bear. But then how, you know, once you have a mass movement, what happens tactically can be decisive. So, you know, but to put tactics ahead of the mass character of the movement can sometimes mean that you're, you know, that you don't get it right. So another place that Trotsky said something like this was, you know, there's a famous piece in the United Front that we often read in our branch meetings that's reprinted in the ISR. He says, it's not enough to possess the sword, one must give it an edge. It's not enough to give the sword an edge, one must also know how to wield it. And so, you know, a mass and also militant movement can intimidate and demoralize the core of the onion, showing the outer layer that it's not worth associating yourselves with the inner, and also that the claims that the inner and middle layers make about actually being the majority in society are false, and that the people who really have the majority are anti-racist and people with left-wing ideas. You know, we can cut out the rot, but unless you change the, you know, humid conditions, you know, in your kitchen that cause the rot in the onion to happen, another part of the onion is gonna rot. And so that's why point D, you know, as Derek said, really kind of ties all the stuff together. You know, we can run the Klan and run the Nazis out of city after city after city, but unless we can get the working class movement to, you know, play a role in helping to rebuild the fighting capacity of the working class and build social movements against racism, sexism, all forms of oppression, and link those things together into a united front that, you know, has a kind of a proletarian character, if you will, you know, then we're gonna be just running uphill. It's gonna be a Sisyphean endeavor in terms of fighting the right. So lastly, a couple of quick points and then to wrap it up. Other dimensions to the tactical questions. A lot of the discussion at this conference and in our talk has taken up tactical questions which arise in the context of these, like, set piece confrontations where the fascists are like, we're gonna, you know, speak, or we're going to be at this place at this time, and we're going to march from here to here. Well, there's also these organizations that are springing up in the context of resistance, the resistance movement, and also, other organizations that already have a mass character, such as, trade unions, for example. And so these principles can also help us think about how to conduct ourselves both inside of and in relation to those other organizations. So one form of organization that sprung up are these emergency response networks of groups of people that, ICE wants to come raid somewhere and deport some immigrants. And so there's a texting tree and a bunch of people show up and, lock themselves down in front of a van or whatever, or surround the van that they're going to put the detainees in and keep ICE from being able to do its job. And so, emergency response networks see ICE raids as an emergency. I think when we're involved in emergency response networks and they have a healthy, mass orientation, we should also argue that Nazis marching in a community is an emergency, right?
Yep.
Secondly, on the question of, of unions. So, we have seen in Socialist Worker, you may have read a piece by Comrade Tim from New York, who in his Teamsters local was able to pass a resolution that my unions should be a sanctuary union. We're not going to collaborate with ICE. We're not going to, any undocumented, In other words, the union is committing to a certain kind of anti-racism in virtue of immigrants. I think we could also think about, all of this is context dependent, depends on what's happening in your local. Can we get past resolutions or at least find a way to raise a discussion in advance about what can a union do in the context of Nazis, marching? So that's how we respond, like organizations that already have a kind of either a mass character or a mass orientation, like an emergency response network, which often include like people from churches and, liberals. And so, we want to, in those things, we want to kind of raise the question of confrontation and militancy vis-a-vis the right. Just very quickly, in Chicago, there's like these anarchist like fighting gyms. You can go like get trained in, doing this and all that. We're not like, necessarily opposed to that. Like it's, at some point we may need things like that. It's not the thing we're going to argue is the next step. But with formations like that, I think at least one of the arguments that we have to make is that they shouldn't have a sectarian character. Like if you're going to form a fighting gym in your neighborhood, that's like, for queer people to defend themselves in case you're attacked on the street or something, don't put like an anarchist, don't say like you can only join unless you subscribe to overthrowing capitalism, like you're not going to be able to actually get a lot of people to learn how to organize themselves and to behave in a collective way that's kind of accountable, which is what you need in the context of like at a much higher level if we really were to have something like militia organization. It's as much about the physical skills as it is like the trust you have and the discipline with each other to kind of come up with a common plan and carry it out. So to conclude, I'm 1 minute over what we said our maximum was. So I'm going to conclude with another quote from Wither France because we like it a whole lot. I'm going to take a drink of water first. Okay. No one has said that the revolutionary method automatically assures victory. What is decisive is not the method itself, but its correct application. The Marxist orientation in events. Powerful organization, the confidence of the masses won through long experience, a perspicacious and bold leadership. The issue of every struggle depends upon the moment and conditions and the conflict and the conditions of the conflict and the relation of forces. Marxism is quite far from the thought that armed conflict is the only revolutionary method or a panacea, good under all conditions. Marxism in general knows no fetishes, neither parliamentary nor insurrectional. There is a time and a place for everything. Thanks.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.